My work on alterity, otherness, and divination in the Roman Empire. When we talk about divination practices during the Roman Empire, we must bear in mind the fact that the definition of the boundaries of the acceptable religion was deeply marked by the need of the elite to define its role in position in the Roman state. All the religious practices which don't match this category, as magic, foreign cults, or all the divinatory rituals not regulated and controlled by the state, and so considered as dangerous for the maintenance of the Roman order, such as astrology, oracles, necromancy, or prophecy, are identified by these very elites as alien elements to the Roman religiousness. This status of non-official activity, established out of the control of the state and often used against its interests, is expressed through the use of the word superstitio, understood during the imperial period as an antonym of the world religion. While religio included all the religious cults that shaped the traditional Roman identity from a senatorial point of view, superstitio referred to all the cults and religious activities considered out of this conventionally established frame. Along with this process of creation of a Roman religio, a religion coherent with the values and interests of the highest classes, traditionally in charge of the main priesthoods and wielders of the monopoly of the performance of the official public religious rites, the reiterative links established between otherness and unorthodox cults will have a special relevancy. A class is created between Roman religion, cult, and divination, controlled by the state officialdom, and a series of religions, cults, and divinatory practices related to groups excluded from the official rites, either defined by their relative poverty, sex, or ethnic origin. It will also bear in mind the link between heterodox divinatory practices and the consultations about the future of the emperor being a serious menace to the continuity of the power of the ruler, the continuous persecution of the producers and consumers of the alternative ways of divination is not so strange. At the moment of analyzing the alternative prophecy in the empire, we face its continuous denigration on the part of the classic sources. Since these were generally written by the senatorial elite, which saw its privileged position threatened by the arrival of new means of divination and outlined its own singularity through the confrontation with the divination and beliefs of the others, our vision of the divinatory heterodox rituals is deeply marked by the traditional Roman point of view. The continuous link between alternative divination and religious practices traditionally considered as barbaric, as was the case of magic or human sacrifices, was a constant in the Roman sources. Our lack of texts directly created by the practitioners of heterodox divination, being the so-called Greek magical papyri and exception, worsen our interpreting problems, allowing the perpetuation of the prejudices and stereotypes of the hegemonic discourse transmitted by classical sources. The heterodox divination in the empire will be characterized, therefore, by its link with alien cults to the Roman traditional religion and with rites considered as opposite to the Mos Maiorum, by its continuous persecution on the part of the authorities due to the threat that it supposed for the established order and to the identification of its officiants with social groups excluded from the divinatory officialdom, as foreigners, women, or poor. We find ourselves facing the analysis of a discourse of otherness and marginalization whose principal function was to define the social acceptable religiousness by means of the exclusion and demonization of the diversity and to consolidate the social identity of the senatorial class and its power inside the state. I have divided my study between the intuitive divination or natural divination and inductive divination or artificial divination as the Roman sources normally did. I do this separation because for the Roman tradition it was most common the use of artificial divination than the one of intuitive nature. So the intuitive divination is normally more linked with otherness than the artificial one. When we speak about intuitive divination, we must bear in mind that the above mentioned practice is by definition opposite to the traditional religiousness and to the Mos Maiorum, which mainly employ the inductive divination. It is not surprising that this kind of divinatory practices is kept as proper of foreigners, alien to the Roman mentality and threatening from the interests of the Senate and the people. We consider ourselves, therefore, faced to a perfect field for the definition of otherness, of the cults that, due to their foreign origin and condition, are used as a reference point to segregate the official traditional rites from those proper of other peoples. The denigration of alternative ways of divination, which goes hand in hand with its identification with practices considered as barbaric from the Roman point of view, will be a constant along the history of the Urbs. One of the best examples of foreign ways of divination developed not only out of the official circuits of Roman divination, but also against the Roman hegemony, are the so-called Jewish Oracula Sibyllina. These are linked to the situation of submission of the Jews to different foreign states since the Hellenistic period, being included in the category of literature of resistance. According to the Oracula, the oppressive state, Rome in the case that occupies us, will have to pay with divine punishment for its behavior, being this prophetic test a warning on the horrible future that awaits the unbeliever. The writing in Greek and the prestige of the Sibylline oracular texts in the Roman Gaul allowed a relative quiet diffusion of this text, which would be destined mainly to the high classes. Their arrival to Rome from the Greek origin can be traced as early as the 5th century BC, which gives us an idea of its deep implantation inside the margins of the empire. It is necessary to remind that the Roman Libri Sibyllini, which were reconstructed from Hellenistic oracular works after the destruction of the capital in the year 83 BC, will have certainly seemed stylistically similar to these works of Jewish origin, belonging to the same prophetic tradition. As Suarez defends, the Jewish Sibylline text not only terrified the oppressor by means of catastrophic prophecies, but also reflect the condition of anxiety of the creators of the above-mentioned oracles before the possibility of the loss of their own identity. The minority group unites through the prophecy, which is capable of arousing fear and insecurity in the oppressor thanks to the use of a means of transmission of the religious message perfectly recognizable for the resident, the oracular text. In spite of it, we can deduce from the sources that not only did the elites had access to this kind of oracular text, the references to the burning of books by Augustus or the investigation of prophetic tests by Tiberius seem to be related to the figure of the Chrismologos, a professional dedicated not only to the sale and distribution of Sibylline oracles, but also to their public reading in the streets. Therefore, oracles of this kind not only will be known by the leading classes, but also by the popular ones, which through orality will have access to the above-mentioned text. Nevertheless, the prophecy is not only limited to the oracular text of passive resistance, but sometimes it will turn into vehicle of diffusion of revolt against the occupation, against the imperial power. There are several occasions in which serious riots against the Roman occupation are accompanied by the appearance of diverse prophets who provide a religious legitimation content to an initially strictly political opposition. A clear example of this process will be the prophecy of the truths, dropped on the occasion of the destruction of the capital during the fights between Vitellians and Flavians in the year 69 AD, referring to the translation peri from Rome to the Transalpine peoples. This prophecy, which has come up to us through Tacitus, has been recently considered to be an invention of the classic author. The position of the truths as traditional enemies of the empire will offer a common name to the Latin writers for all those prophets who, coming from Gallia, Britannia, or Germania, dared to defy Rome, in spite of them not belonging to the Druidic tradition. The progressive repression of these cults, which will culminate with the capture of Mona Island by Suetonius Paulinus, makes very difficult to think about an effective survival of the Druidism in Gallia by the year 69. Anyhow, a prophetic influence becomes evident during the revolts originated in the area during 68 and 69 AD, arising, on the other hand, from the general instability that characterized this period of civil wars. One of the best examples will be that of the Germanic prophetess Bilida. Though the prophetess's presence in Germanic culture is a constant in classic sources, Bilida turns into the antithesis of religio, serving her sex and cultural origins to place her in the field of otherness, transforming her into an external threat, capable of defying the power of the empire by means of the mobilization of her community. What it is more, the reference of Tacitus to the delivery to Bilida of a legionary legatus as body of war allegedly with the purpose of using him as a victim of sacrifice, reinforces the idea of barbarism of the external enemy. In the same way, it is mentioned Maricus, also from the year 69, a prophet of the boy responsible for a revolt against the against the debilitated imperial power. Equally, this figure seems to fit more in the common frame of messianic prophetism than in Druidism in a strict sense. The prophetic element will be also fundamental in the snap of the revolts in Judea during the governments of Nero, Trajan, and Adrian. The latter will be especially influenced by the unction as Messiah on the part of the Rabbi Akiva of Simon ben Cosiba, who will repeatedly use the miraculous demonstrations as part of his politics of legitimization. Equally, the Egyptian religious traditions will have a special role during the revolts of the Bucoli in Egypt during the government of Marcus Aurelius, referred by Cassius Dio. Of Egyptian origin will be equally the Jewish prophet who, during the government of Claudius, managed to mobilize a crowd of inhabitants of Jerusalem to the Mount of Olives with the promise of perform the miracle of demolishing the walls of the city. The multitude was finally broken up by a charge of the Roman garrison. The religious and divinatory practices turned, thus, into vehicle of mobilization against the Roman institutions in the provinces, spreading from the provincial elites in defense of their interests. The prophecy turns, therefore, into symbol of identity of these communities, giving sense and religious content to their resistance, being this passive or active against the cultural, political, and economic change that supposed the Roman occupation. The Roman power, on the other hand, will present the foreign cults as superstitio and will blame them from execrable and barbarous practices as the human sacrifices. I will talk now about the inductive divination and his relation with the heterodoxy with the otherness in Rome. When we speak about heterodox divination, we refer in this case to the set of practices that being used in the context of the Roman society were considered as foreign to the established use and customs and dangerous for the maintenance of the traditional status quo. Needless to say that the above-mentioned point of view corresponds with the hegemonic discourse that from the senatorial order was ideologically configuring the practices out of state control, which will be considered to be opposite to the mos maiorum. This discourse contrasts with the ferrous implantation of the above-mentioned practices in the Roman society, which had permeated in all the social strata. Some of the main methods of the inductive heterodox divination were astrology, aruspice, or necromantic divination. The astrology in Rome was exercised by professionals called astrology, mathematici, or caldei, and is referred by all the classical sources as one of the main focus of instability for the imperial government. The mere naming of astrologers as caldei already speaks to us about the use of otherness as a way of delimiting it from the legitimate divination, in spite of the implantation which astrology will permanently enjoy during the empire. A good proof of it is the periodic expulsion of astrologers from Rome and the continuous insistence of the legislation in condemning their practices, which point to a resilient permanence of the practice and consumption of astrology in spite of its recurrent persecution by the authorities during the empire. The fact that only in the period between the death of Caesar and the one of Marcus Aurelius there were about 13 expulsions of diviners and astrologers is useful to become aware of the menace to the imperial power that the activities of the mathematici implied. Thus, the reiterative nature of the exile of astrologers and the prohibition of their activities point out that, despite the pressure over their practices, they usually came back and continued their divinatory practices soon after the official expulsion from Rome. Ironically, the astrology was continuously used as a source of legitimization by the imperial household, being considered to be the most accurate of the divinatory arts. There was a considerable amount of emperor, from Augustus onwards, that being in need of legitimization, published several horoscopes, theoretically previous to their rise to power, but obviously created afterwards, in which their predestination to the imperial power is stated. Therefore, astrology is a kind of divination which, though it is identified with foreign practitioners, influenced the highest spheres of the Roman society, which will try to monopolize the use of the above-mentioned source of legitimization, which was a dangerous tool for potential usurpers of the imperial power, avoiding the consultations realized by individuals. The obvious ambivalence of astrology, being at the same time a source of political legitimization and a way of subversion of the imperial power, turns it into a perfect example of how did the official discourse, in which astrology was commonly identified with alien practices carried out by Eastern diviners, contrast with its implantation in the most traditionalist social classes, who consider it as the most accurate of the divinatory arts from the late Republic onwards. It is important to say that the expulsions of these professionals of the astrological divination always were carried out in the city of Rome, denoting the importance that the above-mentioned kind of predictions had in the public opinion of the inhabitants of the urbs. The importance which these predictions had in the popular mentality, especially in the periods of political instability and unrest, is capital to understand the importance attributed by the authorities to divination practices alien to the Roman official religion carried out by diviners that did not bear any of the official priesthoods. Such was the power of astrology that, as a consequence of the decree of exile against the Mathematici enforced by Vitellius in the year 69, the astrologers made public a prediction in which the coming death of the emperor was announced, seriously damaging his public image immediately before his fall and assassination, probably in connivance with Flavian interests. Apparently, all the social classes had access to astrology. The laws that expressly forbade the consultation of astrologers by slaves about their owners seem to point in the same way. Likewise, the presence of astrologers in the circuli, informal groups of citizens belonging to the Roman plebs that were one of the main entertainments of the low classes, is a constant in our sources, which generally consider such circuli as pernicious influence over the public opinion, able to rise unrest and instability among the Roman plebs. It is very probable that the expulsions decreed by the emperor were destined to this kind of popular astrologic divination, consumed by the low classes, and not to the court astrologers, who were enjoying the consent of the emperor because of their role as guarantors of the religious legitimization of the ruler, despite of their foreign origin. Thus, the rejection of astrology is not exclusively based on its identification with foreign cults and practices, but also derived from its interclass nature, which implied serious difficulties to the state, unable to monopolize a way of divination which could rise and rest against the ruler among the Roman plebs. In spite of the fact that the use of astrology by the elites was technically much more dangerous in terms of instability, due to the use of astrology as a way of legitimization of potential usurpers, we don't have to discard that part of the rejection by the religious officialdom to the astrology derived from its easy access by members of the most humble sectors of society. We face another way of creation of otherness, in which the socio-economic differences and not the geographical or cultural distance are the key for the development of an alterity discourse. The use of astrology by the emperor, despite of the foreign origin of this divinatory practice, is considered as legitimate, while when it was employed by potential competitors to the imperial power or by the plebs, it was considered as a source of instability. A similar process will be perfectly detectable in the development of Aruspice in Rome. This divinatory practice, originally foreign due to its Etruscan origin and definitely adopted and included in the Roman religion at the beginning of the 2nd century BC, had an ambivalent consideration depending on the social extraction of the officiants or the consultants. The main practices of Aruspice in Rome will be the Estis Picina, Fulguratio, and the interpretation of prodigies. So that first Aruspice had to overcome the traditional Roman resistance towards the foreign cults and ritual practices, the institutionalization of Aruspices was considerably fast. The response of the Aruspices were considered as valid as the decrees of the Pontifices as soon as in 186 BC, being at that time part of the official religion. The institutionalization of Aruspices was encouraged by the state, as we know thanks to the account of Cicero, who asserts that 6 children of the Etruscan nobility were handed to the state, to the Senate, with the aim of preserving the traditional Aruspicinal arts and, at the same time, controlling them. Thus, the Etruscan nobility, traditional depository of the Aruspice practices, is included in the Roman priestly structure, turning it into a not contemptible political weapon. Teruspeques were turned this way into official civil servants, into municipalities, with Aruspex Publicus, as much into the state scale, with the creation of the Ordo Sextaginta Aruspicum, linked to which was the Aruspex Primarius or Maximus, the emperor official Aruspex. Such was the integration and assumption of an originally foreign way of divination as Aruspicina by the Roman religion, which has been traditionally considered as an unique case in the ancient world by most of the scholars on the topic. Nevertheless, due to the image of Aruspicina as an accurate kind of divination, the Etruscan techniques had soon a new market of expansion in the low classes, generating the proliferation of the so-called Aruspices Vicani, which are mentioned by Cato, Cicero, or in the Plautus plays. The great majority of the officiants were freedmen, obviously not related to the Etruscan nobility, who turned the above-mentioned divinatory practice, originally considered heterodox and foreign, into a remunerated job. The consultation of these Aruspices by people from the lower classes, in spite of their persecution from Augustus and Tiberius onwards, continued to the times of Aurelian, who forbid the consultation of Aruspices by the soldiers in order to maintain the discipline of the army, and Constantine, who condemned it with strong punishments the private consultation of Aruspices, identifying Aruspicina with magic. Despite of this, the strong implantation of Aruspicina in rural areas on the empire and in the private sphere was such that it continued even during the Visigoth kingdom in Spain, when the condemnation against the consultation of the Aruspices, who kept their influence intact in wide sectors of the population, were recurrent. It is striking that, despite the negative connotations on the private consultation of Aruspices by the popular classes, its use by elites will be perfectly accepted. The presence of private Etruscan Aruspices as part of the retinue of some of the most important generals, as Sylla with Postumius, or Caesar with Spurinna, or provincial governors as Verres, implies a clear ambivalence referring to the development of private consultation of the Aruspices. Negative, in the case of the not wealthy, because of the potential instability that the predictions of this divinatory technique could raise, and normalized in the case of the elites. In the second century, the use of Aruspicina as a way of religious legitimization of political power was perfectly assumed, being one of the main foundations of the legitimacy of the Severan dynasty. We have to bear in mind that being the Aruspicina, a divinatory ritual perfectly integrated in the Roman religion, seems the consultations about the death of the emperor or about the future of the imperial household, as is also the case of every other divinatory practices, was completely forbidden, being a clear source of instability and a potential way of legitimization of the usurper, which, being part of the same elites, could defy the power of the ruler. As in the case of astrology, the denigration of Aruspicina by classic authors depends more in the social extraction of the officiants or consultants. By means of the so-called Aruspices Vicani, the lowest social classes could make use of the services of a renowned divinatory discipline, being the services of the official Aruspicina only accessible for the elites. Thus, we can see how a foreign divinatory practice, perfectly assumed and made official by the Roman religious elites due to the presumed accuracy of its predictions, was also considered a source of unrest and social instability when it was employed out of the exclusive circuits of production and consumption tightly controlled by the Roman elites, which saw the Aruspices Vicani, paying out of their daily control, as a menace to their monopolistic privilege as unique guarantors of the traditional Roman religion. It is also interesting the point of view that the classic source seems to support relating to other divination practices that base it in the same principles than the Aruspici were denigrated because of their foreign condition. The Greek, Egyptian or Persian hepatoscopia were seen as fraudulent and defined as superstitio. The Carthaginian one was identified with female officiants and the Lusitanian one with human sacrifices, as is also the case of Druidism and Germanic divination. Juvenal, for example, speaks about an Aruspex from Comagene that examined child entrails when tools of the chicken or puppy were not valid. Nevertheless, the practices carried out by officiants from Asia Minor were generally seen as accurate, perhaps due to its identification with the Etruscan Eastern origin. Nevertheless, the official dialectics contradict once again their use by their own Roman elites, since there are numerous examples of consultation of foreigner speakers by generals, emperors, and senators. We must also analyze the references to foreign divinatory rituals similar to the Roman auguratio. Hereby, the Historia Augusta, talking about the divinatory knowledge of Siverus Alexander, makes the only known reference to the excellent reputation of the augurs from Pannonia and Basconia, raising the interest of several researchers who try to interpret its meaning. It is surprising that, talking about divinatory practices similar to the Roman ones, but being theoretically exercised by foreign officiants, the author did not present a negative image of them, as it would be normal in the context of the continuous link between otherness and foreign divination in Roman literature. The opinion about those augurs, clearly positive as they are used as an example of professionalism, could point that they were part of the Roman official priesthoods, in spite of a possible indigenous substratum. The necromancy in Rome was a direct inheritance of Greek practices, since we currently lack of any information of Roman necromantic tradition prior to the contact with Greece. The dependence of Roman necromancy on the Greek one was such that a word in Latin to define these practices was never created, using the Greek term necromanteia or Latin deviations of the same word as necromanteia or necromantia. From the 4th century BC, necromantic rituals are repeatedly linked to Chaldeans and Egyptians, identifying these divinatory practices with a foreign origin. Since a great deal of the main sources identifying necromancy officiants of Eastern origin are dated in the Roman imperial period, we can assert that this conception as a foreign or alien divinatory discipline is nothing but the continuation of a Greek topos. We might say, thus, that Rome not only inherited the necromantic practices from Greece, but also the conception of necromancy as a practice external to the official discourse, to the official religion and typical of some ethnic groups, perpetuating the above-mentioned otherness discourse. Therefore, necromancy in Rome will be identified not only with Greeks, the ones who introduced these divinatory practices, but also, as it was the case in the Hellenistic period, with Chaldeans, Babylonians, and Egyptians. Also, women being excluded from the official divination practices are commonly related to necromancy. The continuous depiction in the Roman literature of women as officiants of magic rituals, related with divination or not, contrasts with the historical and archaeological evidences, as the Tabellae Defictionum or the Greek magic papyri, which show a great majority of men involved in this kind of rituals as officiants and consumers. Therefore, we must consider that the traditional literary depiction of women in the role of magic diviners is more an ideological construction and discourse than a reflection of the reality of the period, as it has been defended by the traditional research on this topic. Magic divination in general, and especially necromancy, were transformed into a vehicle of exaltation, consolidation, and delimitation of the religious identity of the Roman elites by means of the identification of the heterodox divinatory practices with the other, that is to say, with foreigners and women, thus projecting a negative and pejorative image near to the demonization of practices not strictly regulated, neither controlled by the official priest, a Roman divinatory identity able to justify the religious power and authority of the state religious officiants, and theoretically coherent with the values of the Mos Maiorum and considered a guarantee of the welfare of the community, was created. The fact that, apparently, the stereotypes created around the magic ways of divination didn't correspond with the reality of the period is not relevant from the point of view of their creators, whose intention was to define the boundaries between the acceptable and unacceptable divination. The election of foreign or female officiants and consumers of these divination rites by Roman authors give us, therefore, a glimpse of the ideological implications of this identitary mechanism. Such will be the negative image of necromancy in the Roman mind that it was constantly used as an argument against the political adversary. The above-mentioned use was already documented in the late Republican period. With the advent of the empire, this process was consolidated. The accusations of maiestas were accompanied most of times by the lack use of magic. We know the cases of several usurpers that used necromantic divination. It was the case told by Ammianus, which speaks about the judgment only of Hilarius and Patricius because of a crimen majestatis. They used a necromantic rite in which a magic table with the Greek alphabet inscribed was used in order to know the name of the forthcoming emperor. The veracity of the described ritual is confirmed by the finding in Pergamon of a divination table with very similar characteristics to the one described by Ammianus. Equally, several emperors characterized in the sources by their cruelty and improper behavior were accused of employing necromantic divinatory rites. Theoretically related were, for example, Caracalla, who, being afraid of being killed, consulted a necromancer little before his assassination. Didius Julianus, who allegedly killed young boys during necromantic divinatory rites, or Elagabalus, who, according to the sources, read the future in the entrails of killed young boys. But the relation between necromancy and emperors is not only limited to divination. Several emperors were involved in necromantic rites without a divinatory purpose. One of the best examples is the one of Nero, who, according to Pliny the Elder, learned the necromantic discipline from an Armenian diviner called Tiridates, who arrived to Rome in the year 66 AD. Also, Otto was accused of using necromancy, being tormented by the ghost of Galba, as is the case also of Adrian, due to it and the identification of the death of Antino as a kind of necromantic ritual, or also the case of the Emperor Commodus. The practice of necromancy was considered, as every non-orthodox way of divination, negative and marginal. Nevertheless, the belief on the practice of children's sacrifices during those rites, probably derived from the employment of young mediums, made the necromancy be especially denigrated. The fact that these kind of rites were generally carried out at night didn't help to detach necromantic divination from attempts of conspiracy against the emperor. Definitely, the heterodox divinatory practices were commonly related to the otherness discourses, which were necessary for the delimitation and differentiation of the official practices controlled by the state, in spite of its strong implantation also among the elites that create those denigrating discourses. Hereby, the elites didn't hesitate to use these practices, which are discredited simply by their not official condition, being the validity of their predictions commonly accepted. The creation of an idea of otherness, of barbarism, of differentiation against the most majorum of this set of divinatory rituals forms part of a discourse of religious exclusion, of the defense on the part of a leading minority of the pharaoh's control of the knowledge of the future. As a conclusion, and as we have seen along the present analysis, the image of divinatory practices that has survived passed through the prism of the senatorial point of view, in which the male and Roman elites of the empire are outlined as a group by means of the exclusion of the divinatory methods not strictly controlled by them. Thus, we face an otherness discourse whose principal goal was the denigration by means of marginalization of a set of rituals, divination practices, which, not being part of the official religious frame, were perfectly accepted and commonly used by a considerable part of the population, even including some members of the same elites responsible of the creation and consolidation of the mentioned denigratory discourse. Thus, the foreign divination, perfectly valid from the point of view of efficiency of its predictions, as it can be assumed by its use by its own detractors, is rejected with a special determination when its officiants or consumer are tools that stay out of the official channels of production and consumption of predictions. That is to say, the groups that didn't belong to the senatorial minority that controlled the Roman religious apparatus. From this point of view, the reiterative link between cults and rituals alien to the Roman traditionalism and social groups normally excluded from the political and religious power, such as women, foreigners, or poor, is perfectly understandable. Therefore, when we speak about minorities and prophets in the Roman world, we must bear in mind that our sources express the voice of a leader male minority identified with the Roman traditionalism, with values, labels, and denigrates the world through their own points of view and interests. The practices that Roman authors consider to be minority, in the sense of being placed out of officialdom, are ironically apparently accepted by big groups of population. One of the best examples of this process was the survival of this kind of divinatory rituals centuries after the substitution of the traditional religious apparatus of Roman paganism by Christianity. As a direct consequence of this deep social change, the traditional Roman divinatory rites, part of the Mos Maiorum and fiercely defended by the official elites, turned it into marginal, whereas the Christianity appropriated and developed the prejudices concerning the different ways of heterodox divination perfectly implanted since the Pagan period. Definitely, divination, as all other aspects of the religious experience, turns into a new mean of diffusion of the ideological message of the discursive structures that try to impose its vision of the world from power to the society. The lack of direct accounts, being the great majority of our sources a product of an elitist ideological discourse, deeply marks the research about alternative divination in the Roman Empire and the social context of its practitioners and consumers. The fact that the sources belong practically completely to this minority which created the hegemonic discourse led to the perpetuation of the same ideological schemes by contemporary authors, having considered the sources as a perfect reflection of Roman society instead of an image distorted by the subjectivity of a specific social group with common interests, motivations, and perspectives. Vielen Dank. Thank you so much.